Accession number 10687, Reel 1.
Mr. Quill, Reel 1. Can you tell me something about your family background, please?
Yes, well, my father was an Irishman, actually, but he'd... and my mother was English, and I was one of five children, the youngest of five children. I had two sisters and two brothers, my sisters being the eldest, and we lived in... I was born in Littlehampton in Sussex, where we lived for a good long time, and...
What did your father do for a living?
Well, he was a civil engineer, but he retired fairly early on. I think he had almost retired entirely before I was born, in 1913. He was a civil engineer, and he was, amongst other things, he built the first waterworks in water system in Sierra Leone, and he'd also worked a lot in China and that before that, and my grandfather was a soldier. He was in the British Army all his life, and he retired. He was the first of the family to come and live in England when he retired, and of course my father also retired in England, and my father was my grandfather was at one time was British military attaché in Odessa in Russia, and my father was just it was of course in the First War in the Royal Engineers, but he was not a regular soldier, and so that was that, and we lived in this nice little place in Littlehampton.
What was your education?
Well, I was at a prep school in Seaford, in Sussex, and I was at school at public school at Lancing in Sussex, which was a very peasant school, and my father and mother had very little money, so it was they had quite a struggle to send both me and my brothers and my sisters to good schools, and which we did, but we have very little money at home, you know. But that was in the days, of course, when I don't remember we ever had a car until not later on. My mother had a car in about 1930, I think. But
how did you become interested in aircraft?
Well, in Littlehampton, there was a Royal Flying Corps base at a place called Ford in Sussex, not far away. And also during the First War, we used to have a lot of people. Of course, the place was full of soldiers and so on leave, and we used to get a lot of officers used to come and have lunch at our home sometimes, and I remember several of them were Royal Flying Corps people, which I thought was a tremendous, that always fascinated me. I was quite a little boy, and I was only about two, I think, when the First World War started, and less than that. And by the time it was, by 1917, of course, I was, about 4 years old, and I can remember all these chaps used to come to lunch in our house, and that was how. And there was a family who lived nearby our home, and the eldest son was very keen on flying, and he became quite a well-known aviator called Christopher Clarkson, and so he was rather responsible for my early interest.
How did you come to join the RAF?
Well, when I was at Lancing, before I went to Lancing in 1926, my father had died, and my mother wasn't very well off, and therefore I'd always decided to try and go into the Air Force, and I was going to we had an army class, as it was called, at Lancing, and I was going to where people who were going into Sandhurst and Woolwich used to work in the army class, and of course I would have I was thinking of going to Cranwell, but then I decided to abandon the idea of Cranwell because it in those days it was if I took a short service commission I would be financially self-sufficient or independent from the word go, whereas at Cranwell, of course, you had to do 2 years where it was more like being at university, so one's parents had to support it. So I thought it would be better to go to a short service commission, so I applied for a short service commission and had the usual interviews and medical and so on, and I was accepted. And as soon as I left school, I took up my short service commission in, I think, October 1931.
I think, which squadron did you join?
Well, after I'd finished my training, I joined 17 Squadron, which was a fighter squadron, at Upavon.
Can you tell me about the character of the squadron?
Well, it was a famous squadron. It had of course been in World War One, and we were equipped with Bulldogs, and it was part of what was in those days known as fighting area, which was the predecessor of Fighter Command. Of course, we were a part of what was known as ADGB, which was the Air Defence of Great Britain, and then Fighter Command was formed in 1936, and it was part of the restructuring of the reorganization of the command structure of the Royal Air Force, which was done in 1936, and old Stuffy Dowding, of course, became the first CNC of Fighter Command, and it embraced what had previously been the squadrons in fighting area, and were then expanded under old Stuffy Dowding.
Which particular personalities do you remember from those days who served with 17 Squadron?
Well, starting at the top, our AOC in fighting area was Ginger Bohill, who during the war, of course, became commander in chief of Coastal Command at one time, and then and he was the AOC of fighting area, and then at the squadron level we had our squadron commander was a chap called F.J. Vincent, who was a very fine chap, and there were only 13 fighter squadrons in those days. I'm talking about 19 32 when I went to 17, and there were, you know, the fighting area was a very small, small affair really. There were only 13 fighter squadrons altogether, and so we all got to know each other pretty well, and we used to sort of fly around to each other's stations and so on. And
were you conscious in those days of financial constraints in the RAF?
Oh, I think, undoubtedly, well, I mean, we were, obviously, it was quite, I mean, we had bulldogs in, our fighting area had, was entirely equipped with bulldogs, Bristol bulldogs, except for three squadrons. There was one squadron of Furies, which were at number one squadron at Tangmere, and number 43 squadron at Tangmere. So there were two squadrons of Furies, and a third Fury squadron, 25 squadron at Hawkins. And they were the only aircraft we had in the command, which in the really slightest bit modern, and they had quite a good performance. But it was, I mean, the old Bulldog was a, you know, it was a fine airplane. We didn't complain about it, but looking back on it, one realizes it was nothing more or less than a sort of an update of World War One airplanes. I mean, we had we just had two Vickers guns, and we had radio, of course, but rather the early sort of RT, which wasn't much good, and so there was a long way to go. It was quite obvious to us all that we were in no condition to take on. Of course, to fight a war. We never really thought about a war in those days. I mean, it was long before. I mean, Hitler didn't come to power until about 33 or 34, I think. And the expansion of the RAF hadn't started in 1932. It really started off at the beginning of 34, I suppose. And so there was it was fairly obvious to us all that there was a long way to go before we were in a position to go to war. Although, of course, the Abyssinian thing started a bit of a flap, my squadron was. Actually, I left my. I went to the squadron in 32, and I left towards the end of 1933 to go to another unit at Duxford, and 17 went. During my time at Duxford, the whole sort of there were a lot of redeployment took place of the fighter squadron. I mean, if you look at the map, you'll see that all the fighter squadron moved more towards the east coast, and we were really basically ringed around London, you see, in 32 and 33, and then gradually as more squadrons were formed, we became deployed obviously against Germany. Whereas before that, we'd really been deployed against France, because I mean, you have to have an enemy, a theoretical enemy, in any service. And as Germany wasn't allowed an air force, and the official, all the sort of air exercises and so on were set up in such a way that it was considered that the threat was regarded as the only threat that was considered viable was one from France, because they're the only people who had an air force. The Dutch didn't have an air force, and the Belgians didn't have one, and they had an air force, but they were hardly regarded as a threat. So the theoretical threat against Britain came from France. And then it was in about 34, 35, they had to be reorganized so that to cope with a potential threat from Germany.
Do you remember taking part in the Air Defence of Great Britain exercises?
Yes, I do. I took part in two, I think, 33 and 34, or 32 and 33. And yes, I remember them very well.
What were they like? What were your own personal memories of them?
Well, they were rather good fun. I mean, as far as sort of, you know, the ordinary sort of fighter pilots were concerned, we used to fly at all times of day and night, and there were. It was the usual sort of red land versus blue land sort of set up, and bombing raids would be simulated from wherever they started off from, and they were theoretically coming in from France, you see, and so we used to have to intercept these raids using camera guns. And there was an elementary control system in those days. I mean, we had an operations room at Aberdeen, and there was an elementary system of fighter control, which was, of course, eventually greatly improved and developed by old Stuffy Dowding when he took over fighter command in 1934, 35, and 30, no, 36. Yes, 36, 37, 38, and of course then we had absolutely no radio direction finding in my day, and I suppose it didn't become a practical proposition until the development of radar. There's a lot of. I remember when I was in 17 Squadron, we used to have to fly up quite often to Biggin Hill, where they were doing a lot of experimentation with sound location. We used to have to fly up and down while they were trying to work these sound records, and that was the only means that we had of. Of telling where anybody was, and they used to take the sound signatures of all friendly aircraft, so that the idea was that anything that produced a sort of non-standard sound signature must be an enemy aircraft. But I mean, it never damn well worked, and so until we got. Of course, it was not then Royal, but the Observer Corps used to take quite a big part in that, and they plotted the raids sort of coming in, and we used to get a few interceptions quite successfully, but I was used to think myself that it was largely due to a little bit of cheating, or a little bit of prior knowledge of where the raids were coming from, but that was probably.
I'm particularly interested in Duxford, because you may know that it's part of our museum now.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Can you tell me what Duxford was like in those days? Can you describe it?
Well, I went to Duxford in 1933, at the end of 33. To join a thing called the meteorological flight, which was a sort of weather, as the name suggests, was concerned. We used to take a lot of daily readings every day to help the forecasters, and Duxford was only one operational squadron at Duxford, and that was 19 Squadron, who also had Bulldogs when I first went there. And there was also station flight, where we used to do the training for the Cambridge University Air Squadron. Station flight. We had a number of instructors, about 12 or 14 instructors, I think. And these young men used to come over from Cambridge and do their flying training. And squadron, 19 squadron, was just one of the part of, it was just like 17 squadron, being just one of the fighting command squadrons. And they used to take the to go through their, they went through their annual training sequence in the same way that we'd been through it at Uphaven. It was a very nice station. It was a very pleasant station to be at, and it had a rather a good large airfield, much better airfield than Uphaven. Good flat large airfield, and for those days, and life was very good. It was a very very pleasant pleasant station.
What did the work on the Met flight involve?
Well, we used to have to take off at 7 o'clock every morning, and we used to climb up to. First of all, we had the equipment we had was Siskins, which were a rather superannuated fighter. Siskin had been a standard fighting area for many years, and just had been replaced by Bulldogs. But there were, we had, in the Met flight, we had some old Siskins because they were, of course, they were there. And then we used to, they were fitted with various instruments. We used to take off, climb up to about 25,000 feet, sometimes 30,000 feet, and measure temperatures, wet bulb and dry bulb temperatures. So you've got humidity, of course, and we record them every. We had the altimeters, which were graduated in 50 millibars of height instead of in actually in feet. And so we used to record these temperatures all the way up to whatever height we went to. And then we would make out a signal and on landing and send it off to the Air Ministry. I remember it was the Air Ministry at Adastral House, which was the headquarters of the Meteorological Office. So we provided them with all this stuff, and we made all sorts of other observations, and that kept the old forecast going for what it was worth in those days.
Did your period on the Met flight stand you in good stead in any specific ways later on?
Well, it stood me in good stead from a purely sort of aviation type, because we flew in all weathers, and absolutely all weathers, and that was marvellous training for me and for anybody, I think. And so it stood me in good stead from that point of view, and it was very interesting flying too. And we used to, for instance, we'd climb up way above the cloud, and you come down, let down through the cloud. You quite often, if the weather was really bad, you couldn't get back to Duxford, and so we used to then land in a field, and preferably somewhere near a telephone. And we used to ring up the Met office from this telephone. I always remember the number, Hoban 3434. And we used to then dictate the figures over the phone to the sort of duty chap the other end, and then we'd take off again and get back to Duxford as best we could. It was a very interesting sort of job.
How did you come to leave the RAF to go to Supermarines?
Well, that was by this time it was about it was towards the end of 1935, and quite by chance I happened to hear that Supermarines were looking for Vickers, in fact, it was. Supermarines were a wholly owned subsidiary of Vickers Aviation Limited at Brooklands, and or at Weybridge, and I'd heard that they were looking for a test pilot, and I thought, well, I wasn't really interested in that, because I had just been posted to Martlesham as to the RAF aircraft and armament establishment, and I was much more interested in that job, and I wasn't particularly interested in joining a civilian firm. So, and in those days, you see, the expansion of the RAF had started in a big way towards the end of 35, and therefore there were all sorts of, I mean, there were the chances of a short service officer getting a permanent commission, which was always possible, but you had to originally only, you could only do it if you specialised in something and did the long engineering course or the long navigation course, which I didn't particularly want to do. And but there, with the expansion, there was a very good chance of getting a permanent commission from the general duties branch in the ordinary way. And I thought that I would have a go at that. But then, of course, various people advised me to this job that was offered to me by at Supermarines wouldn't wait. I mean, I had to make up my mind there, then and there, or and apply for a release from the Royal Air Force, or stay on and risk it, and which I was rather disposed to do, but I was advised against that, and so I eventually, very reluctantly, left. Applying for early release from my short service commission and left the Air Force, which I didn't want to do at all, but I did it, and then I went to Vickers at Weybridge, and then of course what they really wanted was a fighter pilot to help with the testing of the Spitfire, which was just due to come out. And I joined them on January the 1st, 1936, and I think Spitfire made its first flight in March 36. So.
Which particular individual advised you to take this course?
Well, I obviously talked it over with a lot of people. I remember there was a nice little chap who was the adjutant at Duxford in those days, called Horry, very small man, Shorty Horry we called him. He was a very nice fellow, and he'd been in the First World War and got a DFC and all that sort of thing, and he had also been a test pilot at Martlesham before he came to Duxford, and he was a bit